and welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Anne Aries.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about one of my favorite fruits.
Oh, really?
Yes.
The pomegranate.
Indeed.
I didn't know that was one of your favorite fruits.
Oh, yeah. It's right up there with like raspberries.
Okay. Gonna have to remember this. The pomegranate does go by some really cool nicknames, like the fruit of the underworld or the fruit of paradise. It's both.
Underworld and paradise. Oh man, I wonder what other foods can lay that claim.
I guess
chocolate, something like that.
Oh
yeah,
yeah. Chocolate does have an interesting. It's
the devil and angelic both at the same time.
It's like the devil on your shoulder, but
skewed halo. Anyway, pomegranates.
What are they?
Well, they're a fruit. They've got this. basics. Back to basics. Mm-hmm. They've got this this like thin but leathery, reddish, brownish, or possibly yellowish rind, and they contain hundreds of seeds. The seeds are protected in these internal sections by white membranes, and each seed is enveloped by this individual juicy red or pink or clear little bit of fruit called the aril.
Mm-hmm.
The whole fruit, skin and all, can be anywhere from like the size of a baseball to a softball, I'd say. Like a single fist to like a double fist if you don't sports.
Yes.
Yes. And the seeds plus little fruity bits are each about the size of like a pinky nail.
Oh, okay.
Depending on how big your pinky nails are, I suppose your mileage may vary.
This is true. The name pomegranate translates to apple with many seeds, and the seeds alone make up about 52% of the fruit's weight.
The flavor of the arils surrounding the seeds is like tart and bright and sweet with a little bit of an astringent kind of pucker to them, sort of like a really fruity red wine.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And the seeds are generally edible, ranging from pretty soft to sort of crunchy and just a little bit bitter, which adds a nice little to the flavor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The fruit grows on short trees or tall shrubs, however you want to say it. The Latin name is Punica granatum. And they can grow to as much as 6 to 10 meters high. That's about 20 to 30 feet, though they're frequently kept at about half that height for good harvesting practices. They've got multiple trunks, though those are usually limited to just a few for better fruit production. And the fruit grows from these big, pretty flowers that come in usually the same like red and white color patterns as the interior of the fruits themselves.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
It is lovely. Look up a picture, y'all. And although pomegranates all come from the same species, there are over 500 different cultivars, distinct human-bred types with slightly different flavor and coloration and seediness and all that.
But not an underground seediness.
Oh, I don't know.
A new character for the Dunker?
That seedy pomegranate.
Oh, man.
Perfect.
So let's talk a bit about how we grow them. Pomegranates are native to modern-day Iran and the surrounding area, but they spread throughout the Mediterranean regions of Africa, Europe, and Asia in ancient times, all the way across to the Himalayas in northern India. They spread from there through South and Southeast and Eastern Asia into Indonesia. Nowadays, we do grow them in the West, in the U.S., mainland California. That's where Palm is located, as in Palm Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Most of you are probably familiar with that brand.
Big brand.
They also grow in South and Central America from Mexico and the Caribbean down through Chile.
Some varieties of pomegranate do self-pollinate, but many depend on pollinators like insects or hummingbirds. I think hummingbirds are maybe the primary one out in California, which sounds so dear.
It really does.
Oh. The fruit is harvested once a year in the fall, about 6 or 7 months after the trees flower. But with careful storage, the fruit lasts a long time after being picked, like up to another 7 months, which makes them really good for traveling.
Absolutely. So now for some seed removal techniques.
Oh, yeah. Okay, because if y'all have never peeled yourself a fresh pomegranate, it can be an arduous process.
I just did a Liz Lemon eye roll.
She
did. The first time I have a friend who loves pomegranate, and I didn't try pomegranate until high school at her insistence. And she taught me how she got the seeds out, and I remember getting so frustrated and thinking, why would anyone go through the trouble to do this? This is not worth it. And I had like a high school tantrum and...
It can be, if you're not being careful, the skin can kind of like not cut you, but certainly like if you're just doing it with your fingernails, like that can be painful.
Mm-hmm.
The seeds are messy.
Yeah.
Like if you squish in too hard, it'll definitely stain your clothes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Man, we're making everyone think this is not for me. Okay.
It's a process, but there are steps that can help.
There are. And this is a technique I got from NPR. Step one, cut off the crown. Step two, make a light incision in the skin from top to bottom to make quarters. Step three, put the pomegranate in a vessel of your desire filled with cool water, holding it under for about a minute or so, and then break apart the sections. Step four, go about separating the seeds from the rind and membrane. The seeds should sink and the other stuff should not sink. Drain and pat the seeds dry. Voila! Or maybe not voila. I still had trouble when I did this, but hopefully it'll work for you. I'm known for taking like shortcuts that just make things more difficult. So perhaps I didn't wait the minute or something. When looking for a pomegranate at the store, you want one with some heft to it that's brightly colored. And if you store them in the refrigerator, they should last a couple of months. And you can also buy the seeds already separated if this sounds like it's just not for you, not worth the effort for you.
Yeah, although personally, I always find those to be slightly less delicious.
Huh, interesting.
I have opinions about these sort of things.
You do. That's one of the things I love about you, Lauren.
My opinions? Oh, that's good.
So what about the health?
Well, pomegranates are pretty good for you. They've got decent amounts of folic acid, of vitamins like K and C, and potassium, and some minerals. The seeds also have some healthy polyunsaturated oils, plus a wee bit of protein and lots of fiber, chock full of fiber. But note that, as with all fruit, pomegranate is low in protein and high in sugar. It does feel filling because of all of that fiber, but it won't keep you, like, sated for a really long time.
Mm-hmm. And from this headline by the Daily Mail, I'd say it's a safe bet that the pomegranate was/is seen as an aphrodisiac.
Oh.
Yep, here's the headline. Is the pomegranate the most seductive fruit of them all? We'll get into this a bit more later.
Oh, so much. Yeah, I guess if you have to ask the question, the answer is maybe.
Is that true of most questions? That you could just be like, maybe?
I like that we just spent a bunch of time talking about how, like, pomegranates might injure you. And then we were like, is it the most seductive, though?
That is interesting, isn't it? I hadn't considered that. Ooh. Previously mentioned Palm brought this association back with a series of ads in 2010 that were pretty sexy, I gotta say, and implied that drinking their pomegranate juice would be a fantastic boost to your sex life. Their website homepage features a voiceover upon entering that says, "A fertile and fascinating history."
Wow. So. the Palm brand juice, it comes in this curvy bottle that looks like the ancient Venus statues to me. And yeah, that bottle is certainly part of their marketing along those lines. An article from The New Yorker from 2008 called it Zaftig.
I've always wondered about that bottle. I didn't realize that's what they were going for, but now I see.
I'm not sure if it's what it was, but that, yep.
Yeah, yeah. I see it. Pomegranates are thrown on the ground at Turkish wedding ceremonies, and the seeds counted reflect the number of children the newlywed couple will have. That's a tradition. For a while in China, it was fairly common practice for women looking to have children to present pomegranates to the goddess of mercy.
And aside from all of that symbolic stuff, pomegranates are used for all sorts of other things. Their flowers and husks make for good fabric dyes. Medieval European inks were frequently made from pomegranate rind, and the bark has tannins that are sometimes used in leather production, particularly in Morocco, and other compounds that can be used as insecticides, and I believe are particularly in Japan.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
We got some numbers for you.
Well, we've got a couple of numbers. Yeah. So there aren't any really good global numbers on pomegranate production or consumption, but here's a few numbers from the United States because that's where we live. Okay, so California produces like over 90% of pomegranates grown in this country. And as of crop year 2012 to 2013, they grew a total of 283,000 tons of pomegranates with a value of $115 million.
And these days, you can find pomegranate in all kinds of things. Salsa, lollipops, ice cream, gummy bears, conditioner, perfume, and grenadine, vodka, and of course, juice. I recently made a pomegranate and thyme cocktail called Time to Kill, because that's the type of person that I am.
It was delightful.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I liked it. This development is pretty recent, though. The pomegranateification, that's a difficult one to say. I don't know why I tried to say it. But the adding of pomegranate to a lot of things.
Oh, yes.
Yes. For a long time, pomegranates were sort of a seasonal fruit in the West, but they've always played a big role in Middle Eastern cuisines in dishes like fezzanjan, which is a stew with duck or chicken, walnuts and pomegranates, or pomegranate soup. Along came some of those aforementioned scientific studies suggesting that pomegranates had health benefits, and the rest of the world really cottoned on.
As pomegranates started to be grown in different parts of the world, you can get fresh pomegranates most times of the year. But a lot of these recipes, these traditional recipes, feature pomegranate molasses instead of fresh arils or fresh juice. And in this case, the molasses, meaning the fruit's juice being simmered down until it's rich and dark and much more shelf stable.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. It's a good way of preserving pomegranate for the off season, and features big in a lot of these Middle Eastern dishes.
Mm-hmm. And throughout time, pomegranates were thought to play a role in fertility, and are frequently featured in religion and the arts. And we're going to look at all of this and more. But first,
a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Now for our history bit.
Mm-hmm.
The pomegranate is bandied about by food historians as yet another possibility for the fruit that tempted Eve in the Garden of Eden. So I think this is three we've talked about. It's a lot. pomegranates come up in the Bible when Moses calls the place he's leading the Israelites to as the land of pomegranates and other stuff too, but pomegranates. And King Solomon boasted an orchard of pomegranates with depictions of the fruit decorating his columns. The Song of Solomon includes this: "Thy lips are like a thread of scarlet, and thy speech is comely. Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks." Huh.
Hmm.
Depictions of Mary and or baby Jesus frequently include a pomegranate, most likely symbolizing fertility and or eternal life. In fact, the first known mosaic depiction of Jesus dating back to 4th century CE, pomegranates abound in it. And we're not going to talk about all the depictions of pomegranates in art because there are way, 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 way too many. I got overwhelmed. At first, I was listing them, and then eventually I had to say, no, stop.
Stop. No yes. More. Take out the entire section. Mm-hmm. Never mind.
From the temple of the founder of Zen in China to Alhambra in Spain, the paintings of Raphael and Da Vinci, later pomegranates were featured in post-impressionism, cubism, surrealism, the works of Matisse, Pablo Picasso, and Salvador Dali. They're all over. So next time you're at a museum looking at some art, just keep an eye out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and if you can take pictures,
yeah.
Non-flash photography, you monsters.
Absolutely not.
But yeah.
According to Judaism, the calyx, the pointy part of the top of the pomegranate, was the inspiration for crowns.
Hmm.
Something I read said that a pomegranate in Jewish tradition is thought that it had 613 seeds that symbolize the 613 commandments in the Torah. There are actually 840 seeds in the modern-day pomegranate, but this might not have always been the case, and there's a lot of varieties, so.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Different types of pomegranates can have. I think it's anywhere from, like 500 up to 1,000 seeds.
1,000 seeds?
Yeah.
Whew.
I know.
In Buddhism, there's the story of a woman who traveled far to present Buddha with a single small pomegranate in contrast to the expensive gifts of pretty much everyone else during this time in the kingdom of Bindusara. Buddha freaking loved pomegranates. It is one of Buddha's three blessed fruits, and he rang the bell to demonstrate his thanks to this woman who gifted him a pomegranate. In Greek mythology, Persephone was condemned to the underworld for a year after she ate pomegranate seeds given to her by her kidnapper, king of the underworld, Hades. But they came to a compromise, they being Persephone's mother and Hades. Persephone would spend 4 months of the year in the underworld with Hades, during which time plant life would wither and die with her mother's grief. And the rest of the year, Persephone would spend in the mortal realm. And this is why we have
winter.
Yes. And another thing from Greek mythology, the first pomegranate tree was said to have been planted by Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, fertility, and beauty. And here's another myth about the pomegranate's creation, and it's a little disturbing if you want to tune out for a second.
Mm. And any small children, direct them away, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So Bacchus, or Dionysus, the god of food, fertility, and wine, was charged with watching out for this young, angry, and lustful god named Asdestus. Bacchus did the opposite of that, though. He got Asdestus drunk enough that he passed out, hung him up by his genitals, and used the blood to make the first pomegranate.
Hmm.
Ooh. Bacchus gave the fruit to Nana, a nymph, and she became insta-pregnant. So there's that fertility thing again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Bacchus gets up to some stuff.
He really, really does. Pomegranates were also rumored to be a go-to for the prophet Muhammad, and the fruit was present in Islam's gardens of paradise. Here's a quote from him. "Eat the pomegranate, for it purges the system of envy and hatred." Pretty high praise.
Yeah. It certainly keeps you busy long enough.
That's true. I think it would make me envious of anyone who had already got the seeds out of the pomegranate, but that's just me. Pomegranates popped up in the Odyssey by Homer, not the other one, and in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. The nightingale is, quote, singing in yon pomegranate tree. Hmm. As to that romantic fruit thing, consider this. The first written mention of the fruit dating back to 1500 BCE. "To hear your voice is pomegranate wine to me. I draw life from hearing it. Could I see you with every glance, it would be better for me than to eat or to drink."
Ooh,
very romantic indeed. In any case, all of this aside, the pomegranate is one of the first cultivated fruits, going all the way back to 3000 BCE. Or maybe even further, a basalt relief from 3500 BCE depicts Mesopotamian queen Kubaba, who got her start at a tavern holding a pomegranate. She was the only woman on the Sumerian king list. Because pomegranates were one tough fruit, as we mentioned earlier, and could survive transport, it spread more quickly than a lot of the other things we've talked about on this show, even to places they couldn't be grown. In ancient Egyptian, where the pomegranate was around all the way to at least 2000 BCE, it wasn't uncommon to be buried with pomegranates in the hopes the fruit would grant you a second life.
Ah.
King Tut gave it a whirl. Ancient Egyptians also drank the juice to combat intestinal worms. The peel and blossom were crushed to make red dye, and the fruit is depicted in a lot of Egyptian wall paintings. And a sunken ship from 14th century BCE, lost while making the journey from Palestine to Egypt, counted pomegranates on its cargo, among its cargo. Fossilized remains of pomegranates found in Armenia date back to 1000 BCE.
Whew.
Ancient Greek physicians like Hippocrates recommended pomegranate as a type of birth control, which is interesting. Because it's also associated with
a fertility thing.
Yes. And one of the
conflicting messages.
Conflicting messages, indeed. And one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this one is a listener, I believe named Savi, wrote in a long time ago about how pomegranate was used as an ancient form of birth control. So it's involved one way or the other, but there's differing opinions as to which. The pomegranate was well known in Greece by the 8th century BCE and was introduced to Rome via Carthage around that time. The Romans bequeathed it Punicum malum, or the Phoenician apple, and or malum granatum, apple seed. The word pomegranate probably derived from there, and it was pretty popular too, especially in the summer. Pompey's House of the Fruit Orchard featured pomegranates in its mosaics, and married women in Rome rocked a crown of pomegranate twigs in an early iteration of the wedding ring. It was to say, like, hey man, taken. See this pomegranate crown?
Mm-mm. Not for you.
Mm-hmm. Towards the end of the BCEs, the pomegranate was known in France. And speaking of, at some point, that malum granatum changed to ponum granatum. Ponum was the Latin word for fruit, or sometimes specifically apple. This was the root of the French word pomme, meaning apple. The French combined pomme granatum to make pomme granate to refer to the pomegranate. And it wasn't a big leap to get to the word we have today. Funnily enough, though, the French word for pomegranate is not the same today. Nope. It goes by the French word for grenade. And yes, that might be where grenade, meaning the explosive, came from. They were similar in appearance, and the exploding of the grenade was compared to the scattering of pomegranate seeds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That was cool.
Mm-hmm.
In 600 to 700 BCE, Zoroastrianism was one of the main religions in ancient Persia, and pomegranate trees were planted in the temple courtyards, their almost year-long green leaves representative of eternal life. And one of Aesop's fables, written sometime from 620 to 560 BCE, included a pomegranate tree and an apple tree fighting over who was fairest of them all. It's called The Pomegranate, the Apple Tree, and the Bramble. When Xerxes' Persian army invaded Greece in 480 BCE, their spears had not spikes, but pomegranates on them.
Ah.
The fruit symbolized strength in Persian culture. Early medical writings differentiated between three types of pomegranate juices: winey, sweet, and acidic. Winey, I'm assuming, as in wine.
Wine-like, not, like, complains a bunch.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yes. And here's what our old pal Pliny the Elder had to say about it. The branches of the pomegranate keep away snakes, the little buds that neutralize the stings of scorpions, and the fruit is in request for eating the nausea of women with child. Hmm. The first written mention in India dates back to 1st century CE, and in China, the fruit arrived the same century on the Silk Road. Later, the fruit was cultivated in the warm climate of south of China, and it was exported to the cold north of China as a delicacy. Starting around 1050 CE, it became commonplace for a pomegranate tree to be offered to the goddess Durga, whose name means invincible, during the festival held in her honor. Britain didn't get pomegranates until the 13th century CE, arriving from southern European countries. Once again, this was a food item that was viewed as a luxurious thing for the rich to enjoy or to use as a decoration. The English first called it the pomme garnet, probably because of the red color, like a garnet.
Like a red, yeah, like garnet apple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sort of thing, sure.
After conquering Granada, the last Muslim stronghold, in 1492 CE, legend says that Spanish Queen Isabella, with pomegranate in hand, declared, "Just like the pomegranate, I will take over Andalusia seed by seed." The fruit is now the city's namesake and on the coat of arms. King Henry VIII's wedding to Catherine of Aragon in the 1500s featured gilded pomegranates, and allegedly King Henry planted the first pomegranate tree in Britain. In 1519 CE, the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I of Austria was painted holding a pomegranate in the same way a monarch would an orb during their coronation. A pomegranate was featured in his emblem as well. The Spanish planted the first pomegranate trees in the New World after they arrived in 1521. It traveled north from the Aztecs and Mexico to missions in Texas and California. And then in 1598 CE, with the passage of the Edict of Nantes to end the civil war between the Catholics and the Protestants, King Henry IV decided on the pomegranate for his heraldic badge. The accompanying motto was "Sour, yet sweet." That's how he thought a king should be. You got a strict rule, but you're also kind.
But you're pretty nice, too.
Exactly. Like the pomegranate. When the French government created a new calendar during the French Revolution, the artist Louis Lafitte depicted Virgo the Virgin with an open pomegranate in hand, most likely to represent harvest and chastity. In 1896 CE, a farmer by the name of Mr. Bears, two S's, no first name, has survived the retellings, cut off some pieces of a pomegranate tree in Florida and took them all the way over to California, where he planted them. And to his delight, he found that the pomegranates were sweeter and juicier than what he was used to. He gave this new variety a name. Wonderful. Yes, that wonderful. And this is from their website. So
the Palm Wonderful
Palm Wonderful website, which does have a very thorough history that is, there's voiceover involved if you want it.
And it's not incorrect. I mean, they're not.
This I couldn't verify anywhere else.
Well.
Per se.
Sure.
I tried. Mm-hmm. But yeah, most of the rest of it, accurate.
Yeah. Skipping ahead to the 1990s, the Mediterranean diet started getting a whole lot of attention. It had this, emphasis on plant-based fats like olive oil, lots of fresh vegetables, whole grains, really heady spices kind of instead of like heavy salt, and using meat more as like a side dish or even a garnish than as kind of the main event of a meal. And this has to do with pomegranates, I promise. One of the people who helped make this big was cookbook author Paula Wolfert. She'd been writing about Mediterranean food since the early 70s, and her writing really dovetailed with this new Mediterranean fad, when she published The Cooking of the Eastern Mediterranean in 1994, which won the Julia Child and the James Beard Awards for Best International Cookbook that year. And it featured lots of recipes involving pomegranate, both the arils and that traditional molasses.
Right.
Lynn Rosetto Casper of The Splendid Table credits that molasses with the boom in pomegranate's popularity. Like, suddenly, upscale chefs working in all kinds of cuisines were playing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, fast forward to 2002.
Okay.
This investment power couple, Linda and Stuart Resnicks, who had previously made hundreds of millions of dollars off of companies like Teleflora, the flower delivery service, and Franklin Mint, which makes those commemorative coins and, like, knickknacks and dolls and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They had started buying California farmland up in the 1970s and 80s, including some small pomegranate orchards. And they didn't think much of them until, on the wave of this Mediterranean diet craze, their family physician mentioned pomegranate's rich folk medicinal history, circa 1998. So the Resnicks started funding a few studies into, like, the antioxidants available in pomegranates, and then, finding good preliminary results, set forth to create a juice product that could market these antioxidant health properties. Palm Wonderful.
Yep. That Palm Wonderful.
According to an early company survey, only some 4% of American consumers had ever tasted pomegranate at that point.
4%?
I don't know if it's true or not. That's what they said. By 2008, though, the Resnicks had spent $23 million on studies into pomegranate's potential health benefits. And I mean, like, they're absolutely in it to make money.
Yeah.
Right? But they also seem to believe really deeply in the product.
Huh.
I don't know if it's marketing or not. By 2007, the public media was wondering if we had hit peak pomegranate.
Peak pomegranate.
The flavor was everywhere. Jelly Belly had just come out with a pomegranate jelly bean. Yeah, there was that vodka. There were muffin tops, which were also really big in 2007. It was in frappuccinos. It was in body butters. It was not peak pomegranate yet, though. Between 2007 and 2012, the number of pomegranate farms in California went from 599 to 1,056, with an increase of acreage from about 24,500 acres to about 32,900 acres.
That is quite the peak pomegranate.
it's a bunch. It's a whole lot of pomegranates.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Palm Wonderful, in 2010, the FTC filed complaint charges against Palm Wonderful for their, quote, false and unsubstantiated claims that their products will prevent or treat heart disease, prostate cancer, and erectile dysfunction.
Ooh. Wow.
Those products being palm juice and Palmex liquid and pill supplements. And those claims being false or unsubstantiated because the studies that they had funded and the claims that were based on those studies had some problems. Mm-hmm. The studies didn't always involve control groups or did not show better effectiveness than placebo or just didn't show the health benefits, like, period, but they said that they did. Mm-hmm. Basically, the FTC ordered Palm to stop all that noise and warned the public that they had been potentially misled.
What?
Mm-hmm.
A company misleading us? I don't know about that.
And we're going to look at some of those medical studies and other modern medical studies. But first, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And, okay, they were actual aphrodisiac studies. They were funded by Big Pomegranate, but there are actual studies.
Into whether pomegranate is an aphrodisiac, which, oh, man. You know, and okay, aphrodisiacness can be measured in a number of different ways and has been attempted to by these studies. This does get a little bit explicit, just FYI. You know, stuff like sperm quality or erectile function or dysfunction, testosterone levels, and therefore possibly levels of sexual desire in both men and women. These are all actual studies that actually happened.
Yeah.
None of them could be considered rigorous science, though.
Right, yeah.
And one that I found really interesting that was not conducted by the Palm humans, there was also a number of case studies published where dudes successfully taking a medication called sildenafil to treat erectile dysfunction experienced unwanted priapism when they simultaneously consumed pomegranate juice along with this medication. And priapism, if you're unfamiliar with the term, is the fancy science word for an erection that will not go away for a few hours, even in the absence of continued stimulation or arousal.
Ooh.
So, unsexy in some ways, I would say.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Although, I guess technically aphrodisiacal.
Are you coining that word now?
I am not.
You don't want to have anything to do with it.
That was terrible to say, and I don't recommend it.
You heard it here first, and hopefully never again, listeners.
Moving away from aphrodisiacs, there are a lot of ongoing studies into pomegranate's potential medical uses. Anti-diabetic and antimicrobial properties, skin health, organ health, maybe even antiviral and anti-diarrheal properties, weight and gut microbiome control, and so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And that list, just FYI, is sort of in like the most substantiated to kind of the least substantiated, if you want to play it back for your own personal edification. Perhaps primarily, though, pomegranate skin, juice, and extracts have been investigated for their antioxidant properties. And, okay, antioxidants can, under certain circumstances, help prevent the oxidation or the breakdown of certain molecules in our bodies, which is considered good because the breakdown of those molecules can cause tissue injury and inflammation, which is bad.
Yep.
And that injury and inflammation can contribute to stuff like cardiovascular diseases, arthritis and other rheumatic diseases, and even to cancer. The research about pomegranate stuff is promising, but not definitive yet. One thing from pomegranates that is particularly hopeful seeming is this compound called elagitannin. It's also found in good quantities in some other foods like walnuts. And alone, this stuff doesn't do a whole lot, but when some of the bacteria in your gut get a hold of it, they eat it and excrete this really useful compound called urolithin metabolite A.
Huh.
Super sexy name, I know.
Yep.
In animal and human studies, though, this stuff has been linked to lowering risk of cardiometabolic diseases like diabetes and heart disease and stroke.
Huh.
It's even been pegged as a possible way to prevent cells from aging. In animals, it's been shown to help cells recycle and replenish their mitochondria, which are they're the organelles inside of our cells that turn molecules of food into energy. When dysfunctional mitochondria build up in our cells, though, that's also bad. It's like linked to Parkinson's and other diseases of aging. So it's pretty cool that this compound may help prevent that. Note, though, with this ellagitannin and urolithin metabolite stuff, that your mileage is going to vary based on what you've got going on in your gut microbiome, because you need the right bacteria and in the right quantities to make this stuff actually useful. Also note that these studies tend to use extracts of pomegranate and other foods, not the actual juice or food itself.
Hmm.
So just eating it is nice.
Sure.
But, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just medical researchers in general indicate that more work needs to be done to prove the exact bioavailability and effects of consuming pomegranates and their extracts in all of these cases. Like, basically, like, if you enjoy eating pomegranates, do it. Maybe don't go out of your way to spend a whole lot of money on.
Or time.
Or
I'm still, like, steamy about this.
I can tell. You're mad at it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do some testing, come up with our own food stuff way of opening a pomegranate.
Food stuff method. It would just be throwing it into some kind of, like, I don't know, David Letterman style from a top of our office building, hopefully hitting a bowl.
Hopefully.
Yeah. That's it. That's the only way that'll work for me, I think.
I was picturing like a baseball bat.
Oh, man. That's a good idea, too. I like hitting things with baseball balls. Oh, as I said it, I realized how terrible it sounds.
It's true, Annie. It does.
Well, don't think too deeply about it. Don't think too deeply about it.
Perfect advice.
Yes. And our standard foodstuff disclaimer. More science needs to be done. Bodies are very different, complicated, and we are not a medical podcast, so.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not.
No.
Never take advice from us.
Yes, if you're thinking about something in a medicinal or health way, go to a professional.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we're professional some things, but
yeah.
Not medical professionals.
No, that is not what we do, no. Precisely.
Mm-mm.
Different thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever play Parasite Eve?
Yes, I did.
Because you were talking about the mitochondria and, oh, man, no one else has played this and knows what I'm talking about. But I stayed up really late playing video games last night. So my brain is like...
In video game territory.
Mitochondrial, yeah. Eve.
Oh, heck, I do remember that. See, I was thinking about in one of the sequels to A Wrinkle in Time, I believe it's A Wind in the Door.
Mm-hmm.
They shrink down, not like inner space like Martin Short, but more metaphysically. Right. And they hang out with some mitochondria.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I'm picturing the amoeba boys from Powerpuff Girls. We're just getting a massive, this is your daily dose of food stuff or nerdery right here that is semi but very not related to the
very
topic
loosely.
At hand.
Extremely loosely.
Yes.
But yeah, that signals more or less the end of our pomegranate episode and brings us to
listener mail.
It's much less sinister than that made it sound.
It really is, because it is a mocktail roundup. Everything has to do with mocktails.
Yeah.
And specifically for this first part, another name for mocktails. We asked you listeners, we needed a better name as society, not just me and Lauren. We need a better name for mocktails. And you listeners answered the call.
Absolutely.
Here's some suggestions we got. We got Sean suggested foxtail, but it's spelled like faux tail.
Faux tail, but foxtail.
Right. A foxtail would be a faux cocktail that cleverly resembles a cocktail and keeps you clever like a fox. That is a quote from him.
Mm-hmm.
Karen wrote, soft cocktails equals soft tails? Sounds like an animal. What has a soft tail? Squirrels! I should have done it like up, the dog from up. Squirrels! Okay, there you go. and she proposed that mocktails henceforth be known as squirrels. Terrence and David suggested hintails. Loreleaf on Twitter suggested mixed beverages or craft beverages. Zara suggested sober drinks. Philip suggested ethanol.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah. And since we've done this episode, I have noticed a lot of menus with zero proof sections on them.
Huh.
So that's a lot. That's a roundup of some suggestions. Here's a longer note from Noah. Every year, my town's AAUW, American Association of University Women, branch has a used book sale where they gather together a year's worth of book donations, around 200,000 books, and there is always a magnificent spread of cookbooks. Oh, I want to go so badly.
Yeah.
A very interesting copy of Irma S. Rombauer's The Joy of Cooking caught my eye because it looked extremely old. It turns out that particular copy was published in 1946. Anyway, the first section of the book is the cocktail section, but none of the drinks in the section are alcoholic. The statement at the beginning of the section reads, "To give this book the impression of sobriety and stability it deserves, the alcoholic cocktails have been relegated to the chapter on beverages. There they may blush unseen by those who disapprove of them, and they may be readily found in the company of many other good drinks by those who do not." This led me to think, well, why not just call everything that is mixed in some way, regardless of alcohol content, a cocktail? To me, it makes sense because a lot of the recipes in the non-alcoholic section were as complicated, if not more so, than the boozy ones. Mm. What are your thoughts about this? On a completely unrelated note, the picture at the top of the cocktail section is of two roosters, which I got a hearty chuckle out of.
Oh, yes, and relates back to that hen tails, like cocktails versus hen tails.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could see that. I think it'd be hard to get ourselves away from the alcoholic association with cocktails at this point, but I could see it. I could see it potentially working.
Yeah, I mean, especially on like any kind of drink list where the description of the drink is sort of literally a list of what's in it.
Right.
Yeah. Then it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly, unless you don't know what a shrub is or, you know.
Sure. And it also could just have two sections underneath cocktails, alcoholic, non-alcoholic.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
William wrote, "I just listened to your mocktails episode, and the beverage director of the restaurant that I bartend for shares the distaste for the term mocktails because it implies a sense that something is missing or false. Instead, we have two non-alcoholic cocktail sections on our beverage menu, sodas and fizzes, which are simple sodas that we make fresh when ordered using our in-house made flavored syrups and soda water, and the preschool drink section. Our other beverage sections are old school and new school, so it goes with that theme, which are well-balanced cocktails using flavored syrups, juices, and shrubs, drinking vinegars. Alcohol can be added to any of those beverages if desired, but we add some lime juice and adjust the proportions slightly to rebalance the cocktail for the flavor of the booze. The restaurant is called Punch Bowl Social, and if you want to check it out, we just opened an Atlanta location."
Yes, and I looked at their menu, and they had a lot of non-alcoholic cocktails that I was like, mm-hmm.
Oh, a field trip.
Yeah. So many field trips to go on.
Oh, there are. Not enough time. Too many field trips.
It's a good problem to have.
Absolutely.
It is. Thanks to both of them for emailing us and everyone who suggested an alternate name for mocktails. You too can email us. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
And if you'd like to get in touch on social media, as some of these lovely humans did, you can do that too. We're on Facebook and Twitter at foodstuffhsw. Also on Instagram at foodstuff. We hope to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our amazing producer, Dylan Fagan. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.